You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works Volume 217A by Rudolf Steiner, Essays and Addresses to the Youth, entitled Youth and the Etheric Heart, translated by Catherine Krieger. This is section 14, entitled Rudolf Steiner's Breslau Youth Addresses of June 1924, and this is written by Kurt von Wistinghausen. In the last year of his life, Rudolf Steiner had an encounter with anthroposophically aspiring young people that changed many of their lives. The meeting took place in Silesia, in connection with the agricultural course at Koberwitz, near Breslau. On June 6, 1924, on the Friday evening before Whitsunday, a small group of guests were standing in the vestibule of Koberwitz Manor. We were in a festive mood as we awaited Rudolf Steiner's arrival. Count Kaiserlink picked him up at the main railway station in Breslau after his long trip. It was already getting dark when the car finally drove up. When Rudolf Steiner stepped out, we were all shocked by how unwell he looked. Although it was summer, he wore a winter coat, and the strap of his heavy briefcase cut deep into the dark fabric. My first impulse as the youngest one there was to leap forward to take the heavy briefcase from him, but a slight gesture clearly indicated that he had to keep it on his person. The rules of bourgeois courtesy and helpfulness did not apply here. As we learned later, the fat briefcase was full of membership cards, reissued after the Christmas conference. Rudolf Steiner had signed each one personally, his glance resting on each name. The next morning we asked Rudolf Steiner to meet with us in Breslau during the agricultural course. He agreed immediately and expressed interest in our work with young people, who, for the most part, were not yet members of the Anthroposophical Society. The first meeting took place on June 9 in a music hall in the center of Breslau that had been made available to the Christian community. The members of the Executive Council who had made the trip to Silesia attended, as did several other older members. A second, somewhat smaller gathering took place a few days later in a school auditorium with almost no older anthroposophists present. Shortly after the agricultural course ended, an even smaller group of young participants met at Koberwitz to spend a blessed time with Rudolf Steiner and our hosts. There is no record of the second youth meeting, presumed to have taken place on June 11. This is probably due to the fact that, at the end of the first meeting, Steiner expressed his pleasure that, quote, "no one is taking notes today," close quote. We young organizers were forced to confess that Mrs. Lily Kalisko was indeed sitting in the background writing down what he'd said. Laughing heartily, Steiner gave his approval, but the seriousness with which he expressed his original general intention, never, quote, "to permit printing of things that are best communicated from person to person," close quote, deterred the participants from recording his words in shorthand at their next meeting. Especially among young people, Steiner made a point of avoiding convention and allowing only the purely human element to work. Quote, "Speak frankly. I'm sure the Dornach Executive Council will listen attentively to what you have to say. We have much to learn from you as we develop the youth section, and so we will attempt to relate to you as sons, not fathers," close quote. In his words of welcome, the young chairman had chosen to address Steiner not as a grandfather to us young folks, but as someone who could teach us how to be young in the right way. Days earlier, in a large gathering of members, Steiner had been welcomed as the father of the anthroposophical movement and had affably refused the title. Quote, "But fathers are old, or at least no longer very young. In Dornach, I encouraged the young people to speak clearly and concisely, and a number of them stood up and spoke very sincerely. Then it was my turn to speak, and at the end of the meeting, someone who knows me well told me that I sounded like the youngest of the young. That is what can happen today. First you are addressed as the old father, and then as the youngest of the young. But climbing up and down the ladder of age like this offers opportunities to see what is moving the hearts and minds of people of different ages." Close quote. The camaraderie with which Rudolf Steiner spoke to us was only an introduction to what was to come. We would not have dared to consider the spiritual basis of the connection between the spiritual stream he represented and the generation born after the turn of the century. Now he was talking directly about us. Quote, "You see, before we descend into physical earthly existence, our experiences in the spiritual world are much richer in content and much more powerful than what we experience on the earth. I do not mean to undervalue earthly life. Without it, freedom could never develop. Nonetheless, life between death and birth is much grander. Souls that descend to the earth, the souls living in you, my friends, have perceived a tremendously important spiritual movement that runs its course behind physical existence. In the context of the Anthroposophical Society, I have called this the Michael movement. Here, however, these souls had to find their place within a human race that actually excludes the individual or transforms the individual into a mask. The Anthroposophical movement attempts to look up from the earth to the Michael movement. Young people bring to the earth recollections of the Michael movement from pre-earthly existence. This is the karmic connection between our two groups." Close quote. With these words about Michael events in the spiritual world, Rudolf Steiner introduced a theme that ran throughout not only the Breslau youth meetings, but also the entire activity of his last years. The mission and the serious problems of the younger generation appeared in an unanticipated new great light. A new Michaelic age had dawned in 1879. With the turn of the century, the Dark Age, Kali Yuga, came to an end. Quote, "In essence, now that Kali Yuga has ended, the subconscious depths of young souls are crying out for spirit." Close quote. May the movement aspire to, quote, "the renewal of the constitution of the human soul," close quote, on the earth. In the question and answer session, which took considerable time on June 9th, the burning issue of choosing the right spiritually appropriate career came up. After dealing with the subject in terms of the Michael idea, Rudolf Steiner spoke decisively about the deadening effect of conventional careers and about the need to look outside one's work to find a way to the source of energy that shapes our lives. In this context, he talked about the great Michael festivals he hoped to see happen in the future, saying that he would absolutely prevent them from happening as long as the Anthroposophical movement was not strong enough to celebrate them worthily. Quote, "Celebrated with due dignity, such festivals will trigger great impulses in humankind." Close quote. As Steiner spoke of these future, quote, "festivals of hope and expectation," close quote, he gazed over our heads, as if into a great distance, with a steely look in his eyes that seemed to us to reflect the world he was perceiving directly. Raising his voice, he told us that in celebrating these festivals, quote, "the image of Michael, with his guiding eyes and hands and his spiritual armor, must stand before us," close quote. It was a fatefully impressive moment. His talk ended on an equally unexpected note. Steiner described his book titled How to Know Higher Worlds as a, in quotes, "Wandervogel" book. He said that, like most of his books, he had written it lying in bed, so his critics were wrong in saying that it had been composed on a typewriter. On the contrary, its writing definitely included nature. Hiking by itself is not important. What is important is to see with the heart. A related question was asked at the second gathering, devoted entirely to questions and answers. There are two ways of experiencing nature. One, when you go out singing and talking and experience primarily yourself and each other. And the other, when you go out alone and attempt to read the shapes and lines of natural phenomena like letters in a script. Which way is the right one? Steiner emphasized the importance of the question, and in connection with Nietzsche's title, The Birth of Tragedy, He talked about Dionysian and Apollonian modes of experience. The importance of the latter in deepening our understanding of nature on the basis of anthroposophy emerged clearly and suggested a totally new way of understanding the Vandervogel. Steiner then spoke with great earnestness and tenderness of the nearness of comrades who had died in the World War. Because of its importance, I will still specifically mention Steiner's answer to one other question during this second youth meeting. A young woman was at odds with her parents because of her participation in the Anthroposophical Youth Group, and the resulting difficulties were disrupting the peace at home for her many brothers and sisters. She asked whether it would be better in such instances to give up anthroposophical activities. Steiner responded that after their deaths, her parents would be grateful to her for this exposure to spiritual science. This is recounted from memory. For many people, this statement became a source of strength in serious differences of opinion and a guideline for appropriate behavior in the struggle for truth. The two motifs of the Michael mission and an inspirited understanding of nature came together in a very profound way at the third meeting at Kobervitz on June 17th. Young participants in the agricultural course had asked Rudolf Steiner for an opportunity to present their questions and views to him, and he had very generously agreed. The session that followed was far more than an address. It was a farewell blessing. Steiner's tone of voice was very serious as he spoke of the 19th century's appeal to nature and the nightmarish fulfillment of Rousseau's longing in the form of materialism and its derisively laughing demons. Quote, "But how can we avoid the circle dance of wild demons that answered this call in the 19th century? We must not be overwhelmed by them. The 20th century must not become materialistic. And so today the voice of karma in the souls of young people calls out, quote, if you allow the 20th century to become as materialistic as the 19th, you will lose not only much of your own culture, but also much of human civilization in general. Close subquote, close quote. Young people are searching for a way of perceiving nature that allows them to experience gods dying the death of transformation. Quote, in order to come to life again, in the light-filled crystal. If you can transform what is already knowable, but appears to dwell exclusively in ideas, into real reverence, you are on the right path. Transforming this knowledge into reverence is the best path of all. Meditation means transforming what we know, specifically what we know about individual concrete things, into reverence. We say we are forging the sword of Michael, but there is more to it than that. In the esoteric portion of the world, the Michael sword we are forging must be placed on an invisible underground altar, where it can be found by receptive souls. This is what we learn as we become familiar with subterranean powers of nature. As young people, you must have the strong yet modest conviction that you are karmically called upon to seek and find the sword of Michael. Close quote. Forging the sword of Michael and placing it on an altar, a very strange image initially. Later we began to understand how such images enrich our spiritual practice, since the forging is a soul process. At the end of this unforgettably admonishing address, which was nonetheless radiant with love, there is no other way to put it, Rudolf Steiner made a point that both surprised and moved the participants. As he had done on June 9th, he mentioned the word Vandervogel as it referred to an early 19th century youth movement and gave it an entirely new and deeper meaning. Quote, if you think of it in great images, you will then understand why two words were combined to describe the striving of young people. Close quote. What these young people were actually looking for was Wotan, the wanderer of ancient times, quote, who surges in the wind and clouds and waves of the earth organism, close quote. and the language of the birds, which we learn, quote, by activating Siegfried's power of recollection within ourselves, along with Siegfried's sword, which is simply a prophetic precursor of the sword of Michael, close quote. With his sword, Siegfried overcame the dragon. He bathed in its blood and tasted it to learn the language of the birds. Quote, we must find the way from wandering to Wotan, to Siegfried, close quote. A longing fed by ancient Germanic mysteries is alive in the young generation that came to the earth after the turn of the century. This longing, however, must be understood and taken further in order to grasp the Michael mystery of our time. If it is not, we can reasonably conclude that it will succumb to demons as it degenerates into materialism and calls for an untimely return to the forces of the past. This is what Steiner told us at Whitsun in 1924. Shortly afterward, the youth section challenged us to look forward to the 1930s in a preview of the growing dangers to which Central Europe later succumbed in its secret urge for grand movements, true leadership, and the I mystery of the blood. Steiner's words, however, remain a legacy to the present and to those born later. What happened in 1924 can be seen as a very first step, barely understood by those involved at the time, toward true Michaelic youthfulness. With Steiner as our simultaneously grave and joyful guide. At the end of the Kovarwitz address, Steiner grasped the hand of each participant in his own two hands. Then we accompanied him to the Breslau Railroad Station and saw him off to Jena, where he was to inaugurate anthroposophical curative education. The first youth meeting described at the beginning of this account had a brief and unexpected sequel. I was one of the organizers and was also allowed to participate in the agricultural course as a guest. The next day, Steiner met me in the entry and stopped me to ask, quote, were you satisfied with how it went yesterday? Close quote. Greatly surprised by the question, I stammered out thanks on behalf of all the participants. In the same instant, however, I had the impression that now would be an opportunity to ask a question. So I said, quote, Dr. Steiner, you're writing weekly letters to the members in the newsletter. Couldn't you also give some guidelines for our youth work? We often have no idea how to go about it. Close quote. Rudolf Steiner thought for a bit and then said, quote, yes, that could happen. But not every week, do you think? Close quote. Quote, certainly not, Dr. Steiner, only as often as you can manage. Maybe once a month or quarterly? Close quote. Quote, yes, he replied, and it would have to be something like Feuchtersleben. Close quote. Like who, I asked, all ignorance. Quote, you haven't heard of Feuchtersleben? Close quote. At that point the conversation ended, because Steiner was called away. Only later did I learn about the Vienna physician from the first half of the 19th century and his title Diet for the Soul, which was well known in Rudolf Steiner's youth. Owing to Steiner's illness and death, the letters to young people never came about. Nonetheless, he had given us an important tip about the youth wisdom he had in mind. That is the end of section 14.1. I called it section 14, but I'm changing the name to section 14.1. This is now section 14.2, entitled Reports by Various Participants on the Breslau Youth Address of June 11, 1924. It will be very difficult to obtain an objective account of Dr. Steiner's second Breslau address to young people. Each of us remembers something different, depending on our personal perceptions. It would not have occurred to us to take notes at that point. We were deeply impressed, not only by Dr. Steiner's comment in that regard, but also by his whole approach to the individuals who asked questions and to the current situation in our circle, as well as by how he said some things to us. After the introduction, as I recall, the first question was something like this, quote, when we go out into nature, I always feel uncomfortable about how noisy we are in enjoying it. And I often wonder whether we humans shouldn't also be giving something back to nature. Close quote. Dr. Steiner said, quote, "That's a very nice question, a very good or important question," close quote, and added that he wanted to come back to the theme of the first meeting about Apollonian and Dionysian approaches. He told us very seriously that young people live one-sidedly in the Dionysian element, and added, quote, "You know, in the end, Nietzsche's Zarathustra goes mad. That is the danger. The Dionysian experience must be complemented by the Apollonian, which also needs to be sought out and cultivated," close quote. In retrospect, this answer was quite shattering, because the young friend who asked the question died 2 years later as a consequence of mental illness. Bracket, no further notes are available on Rudolf Steiner's recapitulation of the Dionysian-Apollonian elements, close bracket. The next question was this, quote, title, "How to Know Higher Worlds Challenges Us to Always Practice Tolerance. How can we rise to this challenge as young people who so often find ourselves in conflict with older people, such as our own parents? We don't practice tolerance in these situations," close quote. Dr. Steiner said, quote, "After their deaths, your parents will be grateful to you, because disagreements with young people have beneficial consequences for old people after death," close quote. The last question dealt with relationships with the dead. As the last one left from my Wandervogel group, I felt compelled to mention that only a small number of us were actually present and called to mind our dear companions and brothers from the youth movement, the idealists who went to war. Many of them never returned. My question was this, quote, "What can we do for these comrades? How can we include them in our common work?" close quote. Dr. Steiner's response was something like this, quote, "Yes, that's a very serious question. The best ones died, didn't they?" close quote. He said that in everything that needs to be done, it is important to also include the dead. He talked about the unused ether bodies of people who die young. Quote, "An alert consciousness would develop undreamt of forces," close quote. See also titled Der Tod als Lebenswandlung, Death as a Metamorphosis of Life, Collected Works, Volume 182. A letter from Dr. Steiner. "Dear Sir, in matters such as yours, it is difficult to give advice. Remaining in your present job for a while would allow you to get on your feet, and you could then switch to something better suited to your inclinations and talents. I cannot share your opinion that it is impossible to feel satisfied in a position such as yours, which can serve as an opportunity for self-education. And if you look at the broader significance of your current job, it can be quite satisfying to realize that you are advancing your own education while doing something to help other people. Many types of work that are not inherently satisfying still need to be performed in service to humanity. Once you have worked at this job long enough to save some money, I am sure you will discover opportunities that interest you more. In these difficult times, it does not seem right to me to use borrowed money to equip yourself for the future. I hope you will not take offense at these frank words. Your father's assessment of the situation seems correct to me, and I speak from experience. I had to support myself at an early age, and did so as a private tutor for quite a long time. I must say I would have found your current job no less pleasant than my own, given the uncertainty of finding something else. I am leaving town today, so I have only time enough to write these few lines to express my opinion. Sincerely yours, Dr. Rudolf Steiner, Berlin, July 24th, 1916. That's the end of section 14.2. This is section 14.3, entitled Recollected Images of Two Lectures by Rudolf Steiner on Painting, given during the youth course in Stuttgart on October 13th through the 15th, 1922, by Maria Strakosch Giesler. During the youth course that Rudolf Steiner gave in Stuttgart from October 13th to the 15th, readers aside, there seems to be a typo. It's either from the 13th to the 15th or from the 3rd to the 15th. I'm afraid I am not sure which. And readers aside, 1922, he spoke about painting in two special lectures. Many young people who attended this course were looking for tips on choosing their life's profession, and some had a general interest in education. Steiner kept this fact in mind during his presentations and gave many indications relevant to education. Many of the people who are now Waldorf teachers and heads of curative educational institutes participated in the youth course. Steiner's intention during this course was to awaken a sense of the artistic in his listeners, and so he chose to talk about painting and the world of colors. During these two special lectures, he gave not only valuable indications, but also actual examples, painting as he spoke. At that time, Der Kommendetag, the company founded to promote spiritual and economic values, supported a scientific research institute in Stuttgart. In one of its laboratories, a knowledgeable chemist was developing plant pigments based on Rudolf Steiner's suggestions and had already produced more or less usable paints. A short time later, Der Kommendetag was forced to abandon the great work planned for this research institute for economic reasons. When Steiner lectured on painting during the youth course, he asked for samples of these plant-based paints so that he could try them out and see how usable they were as artists' paints. I had been involved with these painting attempts and the production of some of the pigments, so it fell to me to obtain these supplies for Rudolf Steiner. Number 1, October 13, 1922. During the first lecture, Dr. Steiner did some painting himself to show us examples. His paintings were executed with a wonderful sense of color and delicate but fully conscious strokes. He explained the images to his interested and astonished audience as he painted. What follows is an attempt to approximate his words, though the basis for this effort leaves much to be desired. No one, myself included, took official notes during these lectures. For the most part, the only notes available, taken by various young people, are difficult to decipher, because the note-takers themselves usually did not understand what they were writing. The result is a tangled thicket of thoughts. Another source is our recollections, which were supported by lively discussions on color issues with the young people who came to my studio on the grounds of the Waldorf School after the lectures. After the youth course ended, a number of these young friends remained in Stuttgart, and we got together in my studio and attempted to work out Rudolf Steiner's indications together. Trying to get to the center of the problems independently is perhaps the best reinforcement for memory. As a result, Steiner's indications and guidelines were not lost, but found a place in our practical efforts. It is becoming ever more apparent, however, that for new workers in the many institutions within the anthroposophical movement, it is not easy to find access to the world of color, with its healing potential that promises so much for the future. This is why I will attempt here to reproduce some aspects of these lectures, in part from various notes and in part from my own experience, which gradually developed out of my recollections of Steiner's words. Here and there in these sketches are words and sentences, often only half sentences, that Rudolf Steiner actually spoke. To identify them, these passages are printed in italics. On October 13th, in the first of the lectures on painting, given during the youth course, Dr. Steiner spoke first about art in general, saying that Kunst, art, comes from the word können, to be able to do something. In the world of sensory perceptions, where people learn to see colors, color is initially dead and needs to be ensouled. When the activity necessary for doing this dies in the artist, art dies too. A color, yellow, for example, cannot simply be seen outwardly and then applied to paper. In front of Steiner stood an easel with a nice white piece of paper ready for him to paint on. He said, quote, "The point of departure for painting is the surface. What is a surface?" Close quote. Our willing cannot express itself on a surface because it is three-dimensional. Quote, "Will works in three dimensions. Feeling expresses itself in two dimensions. A A surface is two-dimensional. From a surface, I can experience nothing more than the world of feelings within me. Thoughts cannot be painted at all, because thoughts have only one dimension. Close quote. Then Steiner commented that in this case the surface is white. Quote, colors die in white. Close quote. By this he meant when they are painted next to white on a surface, because later he said, quote, through white we enter all the colors as if through a gate. Close quote. In our efforts to understand this statement, we experience that pure white must be overcome when we paint. It must become light. The white is overlaid ever so delicately by yellow, and thus becomes ensouled. Color, if experienced in the right way, should ensoul everything. Then Steiner began to paint, saying, quote, I'm going to paint some rather subdued blue. I must be able to experience a dull blue surface. The color must be entirely within me. Perhaps I can bring something out of this dull blue, but if it is to come out, the blue experience must be transferred to something. Close quote. As he said these words, he used the plant pigments to paint a subdued blue to the right and left of the center of the surface, in rich tones corresponding to the blue in the center. These patches of color became like a large gesture surrounding the center of paper. The blue of the night sky still rested within it, yet it was slightly lightened by a different color. The blue experience was already transitioning to something different. Quote, I want to paint something that is approaching me, he said. I have something on the surface that wants to work out of the surface. Close quote. So he began to paint the empty center of the paper with radiant forms of shining yellow. These plant pigments, especially the yellow, seemed to shine from within, and so the effect Steiner produced was deeply moving and inwardly transformative. Unfortunately, the plant pigments soon faded and lost their luminous quality. When he had painted this much, Steiner said, quote, that's much too restless. I can help it only by adding a support down below. Close quote. He then painted the earth's surface in rose-red tones. Then he said, quote, out of blue, lightened in the center by reddish and yellowish, which exert their influence all around and are supported from below, that is how we experience a sunrise through color. I must experience this constantly, not only when I paint. In painting, it all depends on bringing everything out of the color. If at all possible, drawing should be avoided. In painting, drawing means telling lies. It means not living out of the color. Close quote. Then Steiner turned to a second easel, covered with white paper, and began to paint again. He said, quote, out of blackish blue, I want to experience something like a cosmic hole boring itself into the color. The hole can be somewhat reddish. Now, I'm playing a bit with the strong blue. I'm giving it a support, which can have something of a different color. The result is a moon mood. Through your own experience of color, your heart opens to the colors of nature. Physicists observe only the world's corpse, but what shimmers and hovers and plays above things, that has a future. Color is the child of the cosmos. Close quote. A moonrise had come about in the center of the white page. To the right, Steiner then did a different, totally unrelated exercise, another attempt to show the young people something of the nature of color. He did this by drawing a profile of a head, calling it, quote, the first element of a face in profile, blue-yellow, close quote. Then he said, quote, the yellow wants to form fringes, nose, eyes, mouth, chin. The blue recedes, close quote. In a round, restful shape, like hair, the blue enclosed the parts of the face that were given form in the mobile fringe of yellow. Here Steiner emphasized the movements of the colors in a most impressive way. Yellow attempts to radiate from the inside out. Blue, which recedes and shuts itself off, is darker on the outside but becomes lighter inside. In a face with a downturned forehead, two colors, red and yellow, are again juxtaposed. The red advances toward us in the forehead, which is inclined forward. The yellow lies farther back, in the lower part of the face, receding in comparison with the red. Quote, "You must recall the creative element inherent in the world of color. You yourselves become creators when you play with color, but you must retain the necessary modesty. If I want to paint something devilish, I will have to start with cinnabar red, and then paint a gentle, tender blue. Red always tends to advance, and anything devilish is always ready to pounce on me. If I paint an angel, who allows us only to look at it, the gentlest of all activity, I can paint it only in the most delicate blue, the gentlest of colors." Close quote. October 15, 1922. During this second lecture, Rudolf Steiner did not paint anymore. His two previously painted sheets, Sunrise and Moon Ambiance, provided plenty of stimulation for ongoing work. In this second lecture, he attempted to address and awaken his listeners' artistic sensibilities. First, he said a few words about plant pigments and the importance of finding the right paint base. In a laboratory in Stuttgart where the plant pigments were produced, he had grappled with this problem extensively and was very satisfied with the result, a milky-looking paint base made up of 8 different resins and etheric oils. Rudolf Steiner had given 3 lectures in Dornach on the nature of color in May of 1921. In the last of these lectures, he specified factors to consider in representing the 3 kingdoms of nature, mineral, plant, and animal, on the basis of the nature of color. In this lecture of October 15, 1922, he briefly mentioned the mineral and animal kingdoms and the human form, indicating the need to find a different approach to each of these natural kingdoms. He dealt with the nature of plants in greater detail, and showed how colors in plants develop in the flowers in particular. We must approach lifeless objects very differently from plants. In the case of a plant, we must experience its earthly and sun-related aspects and seek out the effects of sunlight on it. The plant's primary thrust is upward as it strives toward the point of bearing fruit. This upward direction comes from the previous year and represents all of the plant's most useful aspects. Color, along with the plant's great beauty, spirals around the upward-directed stalk in the form of leaves and flowers. It comes from the current year. The indications that follow are in Rudolf Steiner's own words. Quote, "We cannot develop concepts about natural beauty. Every bit of nature is a revolt against aestheticism. Nature is beautiful when it entwines the useless and the useful. Painters must be able to experience how the flower gives itself its color. In artistic composition, painting from a model is totally impossible. Sensitive artists must learn from nature, the great artist. Today it is difficult for our souls to grow into the ability to design freely and creatively. But the world of color is inherently creative, and we must find our way into it actively and thoroughly." Close quote. Above all, then, we must again learn to sense how a blue spot recedes into the depths, while a red spot advances toward us. The surface, the life element of sentience in its two-dimensionality, catches and holds the life element of color. Blue approaches the surface from behind, as it were, while red and yellow seem to approach it from in front. We must experience color as perspective. Central perspective is dead. It is related to intellectuality. In color perspective, we must learn that colors on the cold side of the spectrum recede, while warm colors come forward. Color must be caught on paper, so to speak. In school, color perspective can be introduced like this, quote, "First you paint a round blue spot with yellow all around it. Then you attempt to awaken the children's awareness that the blue recedes and the yellow moves forward. The blue acts like a hole. Then you paint a red spot surrounded by blue-green. The red appears to protrude." Close quote. Steiner then pointed out the need to work out of one's material, taking sculpture as an example. Quote, "If you're working in wood, it's like stretching out all of the hollows. But if you're working in marble, it's as if everything, the nose, for example, has to be superimposed." Close quote. Then he mentioned that the question of framing is inherently inartistic. Putting gold frames around paintings is the last remnant of the golden backgrounds of the old masters, who, if they possessed spiritual sight, saw objects and human figures emerging from bright gold. Again, Steiner attempted to awaken artistic sensibility and the right receptivity to art in his listeners, especially in observing the visual arts. He took Dürer's famous etching titled Melancholia as an example, showing that Dürer's intention was not to depict melancholy, which means black-colored, but to allow this blackness to be overcome by light. The picture shows how light shapes space. It is an exercise in light and darkness, a study of light's mysteries in the mineral, plant, animal, and human kingdoms. Steiner then said, quote, "Sentimental people will ask whether Dürer didn't sense something different and more profound, because our age no longer wants to perceive true artistry. We really must experience it in its pure form, even in painting. Form must emerge from color." Close quote. Thus, Dürer was attempting to study the manifestations of light. At this point, allow me to insert Steiner's personal comments about Dürer's etching when he gave me the assignment of transposing it into colors. His first assignment was to investigate how many shades of light and darkness Dürer used in the polyhedron, center left in the etching. He said that all of the shades that appear in the entire picture are concentrated in this geometric form. On closer study of a reproduction that really shows all the fine distinctions, I discovered 12 different shades, ranging from the brightest light to the deepest black. When I told Steiner this, he nodded in agreement, quote, "Next, translate the entire etching into color, but pay attention to the two light sources in the picture. One falls on it from outside and illuminates the objects, while the other emerges from the picture itself." Close quote. As he spoke, he gently touched the image with his delicate, expressive hands, his left hand resting lightly on the sphere at the feet of the angelic figure. This sphere is illuminated from outside. He placed his other hand on the light, breaking mightily out of the clouds over the sea and the land. A rainbow arches over this source of light. From it flees a dark bat, bearing a streamer inscribed with the word Melancholia. The sphere and its surroundings are illuminated by the sun shining on them from outside. The effects of this light will take shape in yellowish shades. In contrast, the element of light that breaks forth over land and sea will appear in the color of peach blossom. For darkness, blue and purple will be the main colors used where the yellowish light is active. But in the case of the peach blossom, all the rainbow colors will be used. After that, Steiner again spoke in greater detail about the nature of color. We must experience color perspective artistically. Spatial perspective actually does not enter space. We must also learn to live with the material. Goethe's color theory is a treasure trove with regard to color perspective, especially the chapter on the sensory moral effects of color. Our heads cannot grasp it, but our fingers can, and we paint with our hands, not our heads. Steiner then gave very valuable indications on how the nature of color manifests in the human being. His explanation went something like this. Through color, we must really experience the inner aspect of the human being. This is possible when we experience the color of the person's face. We cannot experience the inner aspects of animals through color, even if their fur is removed. But when we paint the human face, we will attempt to penetrate its color, and we will see the colors of the astral body all around it. The human face resembles nothing else in the natural world. It is the human being's most human aspect. The human body's most valuable feature is not the brain, but the color of the face, which is an external manifestation of the person's inner aspect. Because the human head reveals its truth to the outside, it is cosmic and cannot be found anywhere else. Legs are formed from outside, out of the Earth's gravity. Legs are inserted into the human body by the Earth. Someone with a very clear experience of the brain becomes a geometrician. We become mathematicians by experiencing our limbs right down into the skeletal system. A talent for mathematics does not come from the nervous system. It is simply reflected in the brain. In us, the human nude is transformed into an experiencing in the color. Nowadays, living in color has been lost. Painting with incarnadine or peach blossom is no longer deeply experienced. Raphael and his contemporaries could not yet abandon human forms. Raphael expressed the color of the human form in how he dressed people. Mary and Joseph in blue and red, female and male. In Da Vinci's title Bacchus and John the Baptist in the Louvre in Paris, we can observe how all color coming from outside bounces off John, while in the figure of Bacchus, all color comes from within. Painting must come from the hands. We must recognize the artist's personality in the brush strokes. In the most amorphous fleck of color, we must see the hand at work and be able to tell whether the artist painted that bit of red from left to right, or vice versa. Quote, painting should be done with moving fluid color from pots, not with solid paints taken from the palette, close quote. This final indication given by Steiner in one of his three lectures on the nature of color is necessary to understand his statements about brush strokes. That is the end of section 14, that was 14.3, and that is the end of the book. Collected Works, volume 217A, entitled Youth in the Etheric Heart, Rudolf Steiner speaks to the younger generation, addresses, essays, discussions, and reports from 1920 to 1924, translated by Catherine Krieger.